This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, students at Seton Hall University say they'll renew demands for Africana Policy Studies professors of their own choosing. A new study shows how much force the police use against civilians in every city in New Jersey. And we'll talk with the author of a new book on the imperial presidency of George Bush, the Elder.
But first, there are some in the Black community that advocate all boys schools for Black males as a way of combating high rates of dropout and incarceration and to install pride among young Black males. Keisha Lindsay has written a book on the subject. Lindsay is an associate professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. She's author of the book, A Classroom of Their Own, The Intersection of Race and Feminist Politics in All Black Male Schools. She says there is a long history of Black support for projects that promise Black-oriented education.
Most definitely. And there's obviously a long history of that. If we look after the post-emancipation period, or even during slavery, when it was obviously illegal to teach Black people to read and write, but Black people were teaching themselves to read and write illicitly in the post-emancipation era, Black people quickly set up their own independent schools, and there's a long history of this through the 1970s, the establishment of Pan-African schools, a network of Pan-African schools. In the current era, obviously, there's a push to establish separate schools for Black boys, which is the focus of my book, but there's also a growing Black homeschooling movement. So there's a long history of Black people attempting to define for themselves what constitutes a good education and setting up their own schools. And I think, as you rightly mentioned, I think there's a long history of Black people generally being receptive to this concept, given that the wider society was and has been and continues to be a racially hostile one, including sort of the mainstream educational system. You know, many scholars, activists have documented the extent to which our children are not educated in empowering ways in the, you know, so-called mainstream educational system. I think what intrigues me, sort of one of the most recent incarnations of this attempt to self-educate, is the sort of strange bedfellows, as I think I refer to them in my book, who have galvanized around this effort to separate schools, to establish separate schools for Black boys. So I think that's actually what initially caught my attention. I'm based in Madison, Wisconsin, and there was an attempt to establish such a school here. And in reading the local press, it was really intriguing to me, you know, and then the national press, the effort to open these schools has garnered the support of everyone from former Republican presidents to Mark Zuckerberg to Hillary Clinton to the Nation of Islam to the Urban League to the less liberal Soros Foundation to the right-leaning Walmart Walton Foundation. So this is what really got my attention, that these schools have attracted Black people support, but Black people support across the political spectrum, Black conservatives, Black liberals, some Black leftists, and then an array of white folks as well across the political spectrum. So I think this particular effort at Black self-education is the sort of just diverse array of political people in support of it is what has caught my attention, or not in support of it. So among Black people, Urban League has come out in the favor of these schools. The NAACP has rejected them. So, you know, it's an interesting tension.
Well, what is wrong and what is right with the idea that Black male students need an educational setting that's not dominated, certainly by white women teachers, but maybe by women teachers who are Black?
Well, what I find interesting about the schools and the kind of conclusion I come to in the book is that, to me, the schools attract these strange political bedfellows for two reasons. One, these schools are doing a lot of progressive anti-racist work And these schools, not all of them, but many of these schools also advance an agenda that's quite sexist. And you know, I think in a sort of everyday political narrative, the temptation is to want to categorize these schools as good or bad. I think they're both, right? So I think the good thing about these schools is that they help advance and spread the word and resist the kind of systemic racism that we find in mainstream schools. What do I mean by that? I mean that not all, but some of these schools have made an effort to advance a sort of Afrocentric education that places an emphasis on teaching Black boys about African histories and African cultures. Some of these schools have made an effort to reject racist disciplinary practices, especially those that have affected Black boys. So, you know, the disproportionately high number of Black boys who are suspended from school, expelled from school, placed in so-called special education classes. So I think this is some of the progressive anti-racist work that many of these schools are doing. And that's what I think we should be celebrating about these schools. At the same time, some of these schools attempt to advance this anti-racist agenda through sexist means. What do I mean by that? I mean that some proponents of these schools argue that it's not just Black boys are not oppressed simply because they are forced to learn in racist classrooms, but because they're forced to learn in classrooms, for instance, that are hostile or that are not amenable to their quote-unquote inherent learning needs. So what do I mean by that? There's a push among some proponents of these schools to advance the argument that boys, including Black boys, are testosterone-driven and are innately aggressive, innately physical. And interestingly, some of the same stereotypes that white people use about Black men, right? It's really interesting. Yeah. And so some of the schools argue that, proponents of the schools argue that Black boys are testosterone-filled. And as a result, they are harmed when they are in, for instance, feminized classrooms. What do they mean by that? They mean they're harmed in classrooms that emphasize verbal education, or they're harmed in classrooms that are not physical or aggressive enough. And the challenge with that is that there are lots of girls, right, who are need a lot of motor activity in the classroom, and there are lots of boys who don't. So one potential critique of some of these schools is that they sort of advance not just sort of narrow stereotypes about how children will behave. There's assumptions if you're a girl, you'll behave this way. If you're a boy, you'll behave this way. And also, some of the schools also advance this notion that one of the reasons why Black boys need to be separated is that they're sexually distracted by Black girls, which of course reinforces the stereotype of Black girls and Black women as hypersexual Jezebels, and also reinforces the stereotype of Black men and Black boys as hypersexual who can't control their sexual urges. So, you know, these are some small examples, but this is the complicated mix, I think, that is going on in these schools in terms of the narratives that are being used to advance the school. And it's complicated because, well, it's complicated, right? It's not enough to say these schools are horrible, and it's not enough to say that these schools are great. I think it's a complex mix of progressive anti-racist politics and not so progressive sexist politics. And I spend some time unpacking why I think that is. But to me, that's sort of the crux of the issue. And that also explains, in some ways, why so many different kinds of people have been attracted to these schools and are pushing, you know, making the case for them.
Yes, I think if one looks at the data, Black girls are pushed out or failed from integrated and non-integrated school settings for about the same reasons as Black boys, only to a lesser degree.
Yes, I mean, a lot of things, you know, there's some great books that have come out recently on this topic. Monique Morris' push up. Black girls are also stereotyped as loud, aggressive, caustic in the classroom. So what we find is that, yes, Black boys overall are suspended, expelled, put into special education classes at a higher rate than Black girls. But when you compare Black girls, to white boys, and among a range of other groups, they're also disproportionately expelled. So I think one of the issues to the push for separate schools for Black boys is not that the emphasis on suspension and expulsion is wrong. I think it's right on track. But we also should pay attention to the fact that all Black children are being expelled and suspended from school and streamlined or, you know, streamed in ways that are disproportionately high and very, very disturbing.
You also suspect that underlying much of the argument for all Black male schools is what you call a misguided belief that Black girls are already succeeding in school, probably because they are succeeding more than Black boys.
Right. So what we find is in Detroit, for instance, where the first such school opened, back in the early 90s, and I don't have the exact data in front of me, but it's in my book, what we found was that Black boys had a lower graduation rate than Black girls. So they were underachieving, but the difference was about 3 or 4%, right? Which is a difference, but it's not as statistically significant as the dominant narrative often suggests. So yes, and it's a complex history. So what we find, for instance, is that Black girls have a higher graduation rate, but when they graduate, they actually earn less than Black boys who have dropped out. And so it's a common, the return to education is less than it is for Black boys. So it's a very complicated mix. And that's something that applies to older Black people, right? So Black women are more educated than Black men. The data is out there. It's quite obvious, but Black women continue to earn less than Black men. So it's a very complicated mix and story of how we measure success. Is success graduating from high school? Is success graduating from high school but still earning less than somebody who hasn't? I think both of these need to happen. I think more Black children need to be graduating from high school, and I think all Black people need to be earning more money, and I certainly think Black men and Black women should be earning more money. But you're right, the dominant narrative and the dominant measures that are used construct Black boys and young Black men as overwhelmingly doing worse in school than Black girls. And that's tied to some broader narratives about endangered Black masculinity. And there's a broader conversation about a sort of crisis in boys of all races. There's sort of a boy crisis. And there's a whole literature on that that focuses primarily on white boys, but encompasses Black boys as well. It's a notion that men in general are failing, that women are increasingly feminizing the workplace, feminizing the classroom, and men of all races increasingly feel emasculated. So you sort of got this quote-unquote colorblind notion of a boy crisis in education, and then a more specific narrative about endangered Black masculinity. And I think those definitely help to feed and help us to understand the complicated politics of these schools. So on the one hand, there's a lot of merit in this narrative or this conversation about Black men being endangered. Black men are endangered. We don't need to look any further than the statistics in terms of the criminal justice system, educational performance. The tricky dimension of it is that when we assume that Black men are the only Black people who are endangered, right? I mean, we can look at Black women's rates of sexual assault in the criminal justice system, police brutality. So the difficulty is that these conversations about endangered Black masculinity, again, is fantastic in the sense that it helps promote a progressive way of anti-racist agenda. But unfortunately, it often does so by silencing or obscuring the particular ways in which Black women experience racism.
And in all of this debate and these complex particulars, sometimes folks lose sight of the basic, the fundamental issue, which is providing Black people with superior, mm-hmm. not inferior, public schooling.
Yes, I think that's such an important point. One of the things I mentioned towards the end of the book, and this is something that I've grappled with myself, it's a tension. On the one hand, I think as Black people, and this is my opinion, that on the one hand, we do need to demand not just adequate, but superior education for our kids. Quite frankly, we pay our tax dollars like everybody else, right? And so there's a way in which I think we should demand above average public education for our children. At the same time, we shouldn't be naive to the fact that public school is not a panacea for Black children either, right? There's a way in which we should be demanding our right to public schooling, but at the same time recognizing that Black people have a long history and of being on sort of the losing end of public goods, right? Whether it's public schooling, whether it's water in Flint, Michigan, right? So I think it's a fine line we have to straddle. I'm not advocating, for instance, that Black people we should all take our kids, out of public school and put them into private school. But nor am I saying that we should romanticize public school as necessarily and always liberating for Black people. I think what I emphasize, is that we need Black people have a right to define for ourselves what a quote unquote good education looks like. And for me, part of that definition of goodness is a kind of education that challenges the ways in which Black people of all genders experience racism. And so I'm really talking about a sort of gender-specific way of resisting racism in the classroom. That, to me, is ideal Black education.
And as with all discussions about education, it really is a debate about how to behave in society, what kind of society we should have and how people should act in it.
That is true, because some of the issues that I'm discussing in the context of the classroom don't just exist in the classroom, right? I mean, we have a long history of, for instance, you know, a radical Black politics in this country, be it Malcolm X, Black Power, that was radical on a racial front. But often, you know, not always, but often Black women were clearly told that their position was behind the scenes, right? So again, you sort of have a, you know, politics that is challenging structural racism, but doing so in ways that ignore or pretend that Black women don't have a specific experience of racism. So what happens is, you know, sort of wait your turn. Yes, your issues are real, but we'll get to them first. Let's fight the bigger struggle of racism first, then we'll deal with the gender stuff. And the challenge with that approach is that it ignores the extent to which when we're experiencing racism, it's always about gender. You know, how Black men experience racism is gendered, how Black women experience racism is gendered, and there's no way to take the gender question off the table. Well, the only other thing I think it's helpful to maybe mention is that the push for these schools also happens at a particular time of a sort of turn towards neoliberal education in America, the rise of charter schools, the rise of for-profit education. And this complicates the picture even more, but I think it's important to sort of just introduce that or put that into the conversation. And I think that's kind of been a double-edged sword for a lot of activists of these schools. On the one hand, you know, the rhetoric of neoliberalism allows us as Black people to talk about choice. We have a choice to educate ourselves the way we want to educate ourselves. And, you know, for some proponents of these schools, they've managed to skillfully use that neoliberal rhetoric. The problem, of course, is that when you wholesale embrace a kind of neoliberal educational reform, you often move away from the focus on structural racism to more of a sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right? So what happens in a lot of these schools is that they may be well-intentioned, but they sort of, some of them end up sort of being structured like a boot camp, right? You're a failing Black boy because you're not focused enough. You're not disciplined enough. You need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And so we move away from what I think is the strength, potential strength of these schools, which is a focus on structural racism, to just a good old-fashioned, you have failed because you're a bad kid and you're not focused enough. So I think the neoliberal piece, it's really hard to understand the rise of these schools without understanding the rise of neoliberal education, charter schools, for-profit schools.
That was author and educator Tisha Lindsay speaking from Madison, Wisconsin.
At Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey, Black, Brown, and other minority students have banded together to stage a series of protests under the banner of The Concerned 44. Chris Duran is a spokesperson for the students, who say they represent the 44% of the student population that are members of ethnic and gender minorities. They plan to renew their protests after the holidays to push a list of demands.
The demands were originally drafted last January, and we staged a protest last January on campus. However, this past semester, it became much more clear to a lot more students that the administration was not seriously dealing with the needs of students, and particularly students of color. So the actions that we took around the base of the demands were occupying the administrative building called President's Hall here at Seton Hall University and sitting in the lobby for an extended amount of time, which ended up being 9 days, and we slept over 8 nights. This was in addition to also protests around campus and in the community, also demonstrating our discontent.
Now, your demands actually revolve around the very nature of what Africana studies is and what corresponding courses of study for Latinos and others, the content and the character of those studies.
Yes, many of us are Africana studies majors or minors. If not, a lot of times it is because of the fact that the program is so diluted and has been so attacked, especially in recent years, especially with Dr. Bill Sales leaving. That was the last full-time African studies professor at this university. But we, who have been the most involved in setting up and organizing the demands, are aware of how Africana studies was brought to college campuses 50 years ago and the inherent political nature of that. And the idea of creating space to represent the off-campus community here on campus, where we will not have any sort of conditions otherwise on a college campus that is really fitting for the kind of values and education and worldview and the kind of transformative nature that we approach our lives with.
Yes, right, so at the top of your demands, you call for an Africana Studies program that would be reconfigured into a department with adequate funding and given at least 5 full-time professors of the choosing of the students. That is, the students would choose who these professors would be.
That is correct. It was originally established in the 1970s at this university as the Black Studies Center. A lot of, in part to Dr. Judith Miller, who was the first head of that Black Studies Center. And I believe it was the first Black Studies Center or department in the state of New Jersey. So we don't see any sort of alternative for this other than to be a department, because without it having department status, we have no autonomy over what is taught, over who teaches us, the content, the availability of the courses. All those are determined by people who are inherently hostile to the discipline already. The fact that there are no full-time professors in the program, you cannot offer courses, and therefore you cannot offer really that many majors and minors for the program. And the fact that we have dealt with professors that are not Africana studies professors, that do not have an understanding of the discipline, an understanding of the history of the discipline, that very much goes to the students choosing the professors that are hired, or very much involved in choosing the professors that are hired, because we don't want it to be co-opted. We don't want it to be watered down by other disciplines. One of the courses that was cross-listed last semester with Africana Studies was Western Political Thought. Western Political Thought is diametrically opposed to Africana Studies. So that's what forms the basis of that.
So the students aren't just trying to throw their weight around by demanding oversight over the choice of professors, but you're trying to defend the discipline of Africana Studies itself and the integrity of that discipline.
Yes, sir. This is not something that is emotionalist movement. This is not something that is just based off of us reacting to conditions, but this is something that is formed around a specific ideology, formed around specific knowledge of a history and concerns and conditions of our people on this campus and really throughout the world. And that is part of our mission also, is to organize around that and to make sure that this history is something that is known by people. This is not something that we see as a blind movement. This is not something that we see as simply just trying to cause trouble or make noise and cause undue trouble for a college campus and interrupt studies. What we are trying to do is protect our studies here.
And although it's clear that the Africana Studies students are the point of the spear here, you're applying the same principles to Latino studies and other studies.
That's very much correct. The fact that much of the humanities exists on college campuses today is directly due to Black Studies being implemented and the fight that happened to bring that about. As with most social movements in the United States, the vanguard has always been Black people because they have been the most oppressed group. However, when you fight on the side of the oppressed, you are fighting for all of humanity. And all of these disciplines would not be here would it not be for Black Studies.
Yes, and in that vein, you're calling for mandatory courses in Latino and Latin American studies, majors and minors, and that those studies would focus on the effects of U.S. imperialism.
Yes, for the most part, because this is a Catholic university, and this Catholic university has attempted to brand itself as promoting diversity and inclusion, we see that if they are promoting diversity and inclusion, they have to provide courses that teach the true power relations that are relevant to people of Latin American descent and African descent in this country. Also including the fact that a Catholic university requires students to take core courses in Catholic studies we would like the tradition of liberation theology to be included in that. There are relative significant numbers of Latino students on this campus, and the fact that the Catholic tradition has not been the same throughout the world. So we find that that is extremely relevant, especially for young people to learn to be able to appreciate, especially people in the United States who can only really know their position in the world through those types of analysis.
And beyond the specialized courses of Africana and Latino studies, you're demanding adequate funding for Black history, Hispanic Latino history, women's history, and Islamic history months.
That is correct. This is coming in response to the fact that there is not really much funding that student organizations have to carry out events during these months for the multicultural organizations to hold the kind of programming that they really want, unless it's directed by university organs themselves. For organizations such as the Council of Africana Scholars that don't receive that much funding because it was just founded a couple semesters ago, there is not really that much room to hold worthwhile events, student-led events, around these cultural heritage months. We know of universities such as William Patterson University, which grants funding to student organizations for cultural-specific months, and we feel that if this university is truly committed to inclusion and diversity, they should make that clear in allowing students of multiple cultures to have the space needed to conduct events relevant to them.
And I expect you get some real hardcore resistance from the following demand. You demand proportional representation of faculty to the student population in terms of the makeup of that student population. That is, you demand 44% of the faculty look like the 44% of Seton Hall students who are non-white.
Yes, the university has not made any kind of commitment whatsoever to promoting diversity in its faculty, has not addressed seriously any sort of demands for academic change. They simply do not want to hire Black and brown professors at this university. So we don't have professors that can really relate to us teaching us. What we have is, for the most part, a privileged class of academics who are then in many fields, and not just the humanities, teaching subjects where they cannot relate to their students. And for there to be an environment where students are really appreciated, the educators, and there are no shortage of Black and brown educators around this country and in the state, they should have the same opportunity to teach as the mostly white faculty. I can count on my hand the amount of Black faculty members that I've encountered at this university.
And what's the state of negotiations with Seton Hall?
Seton Hall University continues to try to present the narrative that they are cleaning up its act, that they are listening and addressing the needs of students. However, on the first two demands that deal with curriculum and faculty, they have not addressed whatsoever. What they have done is pretty much reword things that already exist or allow for concessions that do not actually address the problem. In terms of negotiations, there is not much basis to negotiate when one side is not necessarily fearing any consequence. And so we are currently in a state of organizing to push for our demands as we have articulated, and we will not be satisfied until those demands are addressed fully. The Seton Hall administration has, with regard to Africana studies, said that they will allow one hire of someone on a 3-year contract in which they would work 12 months out of the year to both promote Africana studies and teach the courses. We find this position, which is called the Director of Africana Studies, to not be sufficient whatsoever because there is no real goal after 3 years. And what this could easily do is just break down the program even more. With Latino studies, all they did was reword a hire that the English department had already set out without consulting the Latino studies program, where they will hire an English professor who can translate Latino works. But this is something that was not needed by the Latino studies program, saying that they already have tenured faculty to teach literature in their own program. and is done without consultation from Africana or Latino Studies programs whatsoever. So we continue to see a blatant disrespect by the university for these disciplines and for the real needs of students. And we continue to see no real goals or commitments being set out by the university other than things that were already in place, but they are just rewording to give the appearance that they are doing something.
And for this, you believe there should be consequences. What's your plan of action?
Without giving away too much, next semester we do plan on carrying out more direct actions and organizing the movement further to the point where there can be real power built for students that is representative of building power also in the outside community. The university is located right outside of Newark. However, again, I can count on my hand the amount of students that I know here that are actually from Newark. The fact that this university continues to brand itself appropriating what are called in the United States minority cultures, and yet continues to simply just exploit them and not make any commitment to their actual needs, has made us determined to create our own space where we can empower ourselves and where we can provide a model for community empowerment. And so in terms of organizing, we are committed to also being much more disciplined in terms of carrying out political education classes and overall aspects of life when it comes to healthy eating, meditation, things that are oriented around a tradition that we have learned from people such as the MOVE organization, the Black Panther Party, and the kind of programs that they had. And so we see ourselves sort of as a vanguard for that sort of movement, at least on the college campus.
That was Chris Duran, spokesperson for the Concerned 44 students at Seton Hall University in northern New Jersey.
Also in that state, New Jersey Advanced Media released a report documenting how police departments in every town and city in the state use force against civilians. Activists on the ground have found the report to be very useful in pressing their case against police racism and brutality. Zaid Muhammad is a veteran organizer with the Newark Communities for Accountable Policing for NCAP. We asked Zaid if there were any surprises in the New Jersey Advanced Media report.
Well, the first surprise is that it came from them, of all places, because that entity and its mother iteration, Star Ledger, have been in denial and have not been terribly willing to investigate in a very real way this phenomenon that we've been facing since the institution has come into being. So that's the first surprise. Second surprise is that it was as exhaustive as it was. And I have to concede that I'm glad they did it and did it at that level. Third surprise is that we have a new attorney general who had to bear witness to how out of touch and how inappropriate it was that it did not come from the state when it was supposed to have come from the state almost two decades ago. And it remains to be seen how far he will be turned around in implementing something similar and the other things that need to be implemented to make police accountability something real. But it is there, and it is there to deal with, and we should all look at it as a tool or a weapon to help move the issue, and it needs to be moved on so many fronts.
You're, of course, based in Newark. How does Newark, New Jersey's biggest city and one of its blackest, how does it fare in that report?
It's mixed bag, mixed bag. And some will say that because of the reform efforts in place now under this federal monitor, that things are going in the right direction. On the surface, that appears to be so. According to that report, it could go either way, and there's a current tick actually going upward towards a larger use of force than perhaps need be. So we need to be vigilant even in this process where there's some oversight involved. But I would go further. Newark in this, Newark also, the thing that was not mentioned in this that was very important in my modest judgment is that, well, what do we do now? What needs to be in place? And the thing that was glaringly missing is the whole question of civilian oversight. in Newark, we're in the throes of a fight for a civilian review board that was impaneled and put in place by Mayor Ras Baraka that was like none unto the any other in the country. And as soon as we got it in place, the other side, under the leadership of the Fraternal Order of Police, went into court to block its implementation with the authority that we need to make the kind of accountability that we're talking about real. So we all need to get there. We all need to get to that place where we should have real, meaningful civilian oversight of the police. We should have real, meaningful civilian oversight instrumentalities, like a fully empowered civilian review board, the way we have constructed here in Newark, and that municipalities clearly throughout the state need similar instrumentalities as well. And then finally, at the very top of the list, was the fact that the city that seemed to have the biggest problem is one of those cities not far from Newark, one of its affluent suburbs, that has always postured as being one of the liberal paragons in the state of New Jersey, Maplewood. This report surely contradicts that. We just had a case in Maplewood where police, after the 4th of July, of all things, young people actually celebrating the birth of this country, even though the birth of this country had nothing to do with our freedom, celebrating the 4th of July, because they were black, were corralled, led by the police chief, into the next town that has a black majority, into Irvington. And then that corral was very forceful, and one particular young man was literally taken down, beaten, kicked in the head, arrested, and then charged with assault to the police officer. They forgot that they had their own all this stuff on videotape. And they fought community forces tooth and nail to prevent that videotape from coming forward. And when, of course, we won in court and got that footage, it exposed that abuse in that particular incident, in that particular moment, for what it is, and it got some modicum of justice for that young man that was lucky enough to survive that abuse. So for all of the facade of liberalism in the Garden State is, as we always said it was, the racist up south soprano state, and it's been in the forefront of police abuse and racism as it has been for as long as it has been around and we have been around here under the shackles of slavery.
And you at NCAP, the Newark Communities of Accountable Policing, have been calling for a special prosecutor to tackle these kinds of police abuse cases. But your attorney general, the state attorney general, hasn't gone along with that.
Right. Well, the time has come to turn his behind around. And this is right in his face, and he has acknowledged as much. So the time has come for progressive forces, black and brown and otherwise, to unite and to push for that bill to be implemented, to raise the bar, and dare to challenge folks of all stripes that if New Jersey is to be anywhere it says it's supposed to be, the time for these implementations are now.
And what about Newark's Civilian Complaint Review Board? It's been stymied by the courts under litigation brought by the Fraternal Order of Police, as you explained, but how are you going to get off the dime on that?
Time will tell. On October 22nd, the National Day Against Police Brutality, where some 23 cities did actions around the country on police brutality, we actually did a rally and march right on the Fraternal Order of Police's headquarters to put them on blast and let them know that they're no longer going to be isolated and protected in a perch of privilege in this question, and we are going to force this discussion and force them into a place where they haven't been before, that they need to go. We took a loss a few minutes ago under state judge, Judge Donald Kessler, who took 3.5 hours to lecture a full courtroom of black and brown people why we couldn't have what we wanted. We're appealing that in court and in the process of organizing statewide support to support our appeal on that. At some point, we may have to rally in Trenton for this case on appeal, as we will have to rally for the creation of this bill to create this independent prosecutor.
In the absence of institutions that can effectively rein in the police, the people on the street have to do what they've got to do. And you're recommending something called a mobile justice app.
ACLU gets credit for that. This is one of their babies in this cell phone age that we live in. Videotape does matter. sometimes it makes a difference in the quest for police brutality, justice, and sometimes it doesn't. But more often than not, when it's involved, it gives the people's side a chance at some justice. This is an app that actually allows not only people to record the police, but it creates a report at the same time. And if the police confiscate or destroy your phone, whether that happens or not, that videotape is going right to the ACLU. So it's protected. It's a protected app that gives people another tool, another weapon to defend themselves in the scourge of police brutality. The ACLU has branches all over the country by state. So if you were in New Jersey, you would download Mobile Justice App ACLU New Jersey. If you're in an adjoining state or a different state, you would do it for that particular state. But it's built for each state that the ACLU is in.
Now, you say that there's been a perceptible decline in police use of force in Newark, and you attribute that to the consent decree. That's been a couple of years. It hasn't worn off yet, huh?
Not yet. Not yet. I mean, police brutality and the use of police force, especially along the color line, has been the cutting edge of the maintenance of white supremacy since its inception. This is an ingrained, deeply ingrained problem that was going to take some time. Even if we put the proper instrumentalities of reform in place, it's going to take time to change that deep-seated culture of hate and abuse that is built on putting our people in our place. So this, while there's this engagement, for lack of a better word, or that's the popular term that's used in these circles now, there's this engagement right now between the community and the police. The police are, by force of this oversight, having to at least try to be on their best behavior. Some are doing well, some are not. And we are raising our rate of volume whenever we are informed of improper policing or bad policing. And we will continue to do that. And we want folks to not at all be passive just because this instrumentality is in place. Consent decrees come and go. Different kinds of leadership comes and go. This is something that was going to require a sustained attention, sustained vigilance, sustained action, sustained pressure, because it's a protracted problem, as our struggle is a protracted struggle. Absolutely.
That was Zaid Muhammad of Newark Communities for Accountable Policing.
George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st U.S. president and father of president number 43, was laid to rest 2 weeks ago with great pomp and ceremony. We spoke with noted author and professor of politics, Anthony DiMaggio, who wrote an article for Counterpunch titled Imperialist in Chief, A Critical History of George H.W. Bush's War on Iraq. DiMaggio says all U.S. presidents of either party are about the business of building and defending the U.S. empire.
This is a bipartisan imperial commitment, so it's frustrating when you see some of the commentaries in the news, particularly from really across the board, talking about what I would call sort of this grand men of history narrative. I'm going to sort of personalize this and make it into a leadership issue, looking at each individual president's personality. And, you know, I really just don't see it that way at all. In terms of looking at the history of this, you see a pretty consistent record across both political parties of a commitment to, like, for lack of a better word, empire, really. So whether it's sort of the more, I guess you could say, liberal, humanitarian, rhetoric-based imperialism of the Obama and Clinton administrations, or the more brazen sort of in-your-face imperialism of George W. Bush. You know, we're really talking about the same phenomenon here, and I think that's really clear when you look at the actual, what are now declassified policy planning records of these administrations and also their national security statements. They're different in some ways in terms of the rhetoric, but, you know, for example, the Obama administration, they were much smoother in their rhetoric talking about things like global cooperation and human rights. And there was less of that in the case of the George W. Bush administration and the George H.W. Bush administration. But really, they all have the thing in common of being committed to empire.
And the Gulf War was really the first U.S. sole superpower exercise after the fall of the Soviet Union. That is, the United States seeing what it could get away with in the world.
I think the key there is, you know, the real announcement from the records I've looked at, if you go back to the 1991 national security strategy. This is really sort of the coming out party for the Bush senior administration. They were very clear in that document that the United States was going to play second fiddle to no one. Now that the Soviet Union was gone, we weren't going to pull back from the Middle East, where our primary concern was and is oil. And they said that very explicitly in the national security strategy. But we couldn't lay the alleged threats to U.S. power at the Kremlin's door anymore. This is also from the document. So, you know, any other country that might stand in our way, we're going to essentially come after them. We're going to keep a strong military presence in the region, and we're going to keep doing what we've been doing. And so you have sort of a trail of documents from the first Bush administration. That's exactly what you were talking about, you know, this idea of the United States as the last global power, the last global empire. So you see this with regards to discussions of Iraq. You see it in terms of a general discussion of the Middle East. There are other documents as well that could be talked about and covered, but they were very clear about this.
And of course, with no Soviet Union to stand in their way, the United States saw the way clear internationally, but there was still the question of the U.S. public. Would they go along with this kind of stepped-up warfare imperial policy? But we see that, and as you document, support for some kind of military action against Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq was only at 21% in August of 1990. But by January of 91, they'd ramped it up to 49%. And by the time the U.S. actually attacked Iraq, 75% of the American people said that the war was worth it.
Yes, I think that realistically, it's sort of hard to disentangle some of the things that are going on here, but I think it's pretty clear that a couple of things were going on. Number one, whenever you have American troops that are going into a war situation, you obviously have this rally around the flag phenomenon where people sort of suspend disbelief at the exact time when they should be asking the most questions. And that can oftentimes and does contribute to a big growth in support for war. And I think another big part of this that really can't be ignored is the way in which this administration shamelessly used propaganda and rhetoric, very one-sided rhetoric and even bald-faced lies to sell war. And, you know, this is the way that this typically works when you look at U.S. wars is you have to scare people out of their mind. You have to use the rhetoric of fear. And that was definitely the case in the case of Iraq. Human rights-related rhetoric about Saddam Hussein, the butcher of Baghdad, particularly related to this idea that his troops had gone into Kuwait and taken Kuwaiti babies and thrown them on the floor, premature babies, and stolen their incubators to take back to Iraq, which we know shortly after this rhetoric sort of emerged that it just was a blatant lie. It had come from the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador who was part of this royal family government establishment, and it was part of a propaganda campaign that family had paid for on the part of the Kuwaiti establishment to try and convince Americans that this was about human rights, when the reality of the situation was that while Saddam Hussein was a repressive leader, the U.S. had known this for years and years and had supported him through his worst atrocities and his worst gassings of the Kurds and Iranian troops and all of his domestic repression. So, you know, there are these things that really needed to be talked about in the run-up to the war, and they really weren't in any systematic way in the U.S. media. So you had a lot of fearful rhetoric about Saddam Hussein as sort of the second coming of Hitler, who had chemical and nuclear weapons, supposedly. He had violated international law, and we needed to support these principles of international law against aggression, and we needed to punish him for human rights violations. But really, all of this systematically just ignored the U.S. hand in creating this monster, this butcher of Baghdad.
Now, I know that you're keen to emphasize the continuity of U.S. imperial policy rather than the different quirks of the various presidents. But is there anything different about this president, the one we have in the Oval Office now?
Well, there are some differences in terms of procedure and style. I mean, if you look generally, I would say, at the Trump administration, he has sort of parroted a lot of the same rhetoric of nationalism and imperialism that goes back to the George H.W. Bush administration. I'm quoting him right now. He celebrated this former president, this late president, and his, quote, unwavering commitment to his country. He was an inspiring man who was humble and of sound judgment and unflappable leadership. So there has been some talk about the Trump administration in some ways in which maybe his policy would be different than other leaders in terms of how he would deal with Russia versus China, and maybe there's some sort of break in the way he's talking about dealing with Russia compared to the very militaristic rhetoric of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. So I don't want to say that there aren't differences, but I would say, generally speaking, I haven't got the impression from this president that he is some sort of principled anti-imperialist.
One difference in today's era that I think is palpable is that the Democrats are so aggressively part of the war party or leading it.
Well, it's a great point. I've been writing for a long time about the propaganda of the Obama administration, and I teach a class on propaganda, so it's interesting to sort of compare his propaganda to that of Trump. The Trump propaganda is much more sort of Orwellian, in-your-face sort of lack of interest in basic things like facts, but the Obama propaganda is much more subtle and I think, as a result, much more devious and effective. I think if we were talking about propagandists in America in the 21st century, maybe the Trump administration is the most brazen in their propaganda, but the Obama administration was the most dangerous. You had a president who won a Nobel Peace Prize based on the rhetoric of peace, who spent more money in his first 4 years in office on the military and on war than George W. Bush spent in the first 4 years after 9/11. Did you think about that for a minute? How incredible that is, almost 10 years out of 9/11, within those first 4 years, to have spent more money than after 9/11. It really shows his commitment to imperialism. But there was this rhetoric of peace and human rights and cooperation. And it's really quite fascinating that it wasn't just American liberals who bought into this silliness. It was people throughout most of the world. If you look at global public opinion polls, they were very negative toward the Bush administration because they were seen as very brazen in their sort of lack of interest in what the world thought. And it was very different with the Obama administration because of that rhetoric. People bought hook, line, and sinker into his propaganda, where in reality you had drone strikes across multiple countries, blatant violations of international law, expansion of militarism in Libya and Afghanistan. It was no anti-war administration. That's really quite an Orwellian thing to think that people actually had that impression. But, you know, really outside of the Middle East, polls across the world showed that people bought into this rhetoric, that he was very gifted in that sense.
Yes, we can call Donald Trump rough and Barack Obama very, very smooth. And during Obama's tenure in the White House, we saw the virtual evaporation of the anti-war movement and also the neutralization of whatever was left of the black movement.
This is one of the big tragedies of when you talk about progressive social movements getting co-opted into government agendas. You had what was a pretty vibrant anti-war movement in the early 2000s, and I think a lot of the sail really got cut out of that movement when the Democrats took power in 2006. They took over Congress, and then Obama, the quote, anti-war president, came into power. People just sort of assumed that he was going to take care of this war in Iraq. I don't think that was really an assumption that really merited any sort of, I don't think it should be taken seriously, in other words. I mean, his militarism was a much more, I guess you would say, refined version. You could call him a refined imperialist in terms of these expanded military conflicts that he got the U.S. involved in. But yes, that's true. I mean, that's one of the big, when you look at social movements, it's a sign of their success and failure, really. So they get taken seriously by these major political parties, but then they get co-opted and their purpose gets corrupted. So the very sign of their success, that they are getting attention and can no longer be ignored, also ends up working against them as these parties try to sort of pervert and co-opt them.
Back to the Trump era, there's this thing that calls itself the resistance. Who is the resistance? What is it?
This is sort of interesting. I've been working on a book project on protests post-2008, and one of the chapters talks about what I guess you could call the resistance to Trump. It's really sort of interesting because it's this crazy quilt coalition of people that is so wide that sometimes it's hard to really know that it has any coherence at all. If you look at public opinion polls, it's pretty clear that the people who say that they've been attending anti-Trump protests are progressive leftists. Based on my attendance at various protests in the last 2 years, you know, I would say it's definitely a mix of liberals, some moderates, progressives, maybe some radicals. But outside of protests in the streets, you've got the attempt of political leaders like Hillary Clinton to sort of co-opt this movement, as I've been talking about co-optation. You know, when Hillary Clinton can say she is the resistance, you know that there's something strange going on in terms of, well, I guess you could say strange bedfellows, really. I mean, you've got genuine progressive sort of left people who are committed to causes like anti-racism, anti-sexism, anti-classism. And then you've got this sort of mainstream element. So it's an odd mix of people. And so that's sort of, in one sense, you could say a strength to the movement that it's got a wide sort of support, but it's also a limit. And it's also a real weakness because what is it? What does it stand for? And what does it stand for moving forward? If you don't figure that out and have an agenda that goes beyond corporate neoliberal democratic politics, then it's not much of anything, really.
You and I have been talking mostly about foreign policy for the past 15 minutes, but Bernie Sanders doesn't like to talk about foreign policy at all.
Well, he's part of this imperial machine, despite what a lot of people on the left like about his domestic policy. They talk about, you know, this idea of progressive taxation, universal health care. I'm not going to protest universal health care. I think that's a great idea. But yeah, he's as part of what you would call this military-industrial complex. He's been a part of it as for really years and years and years, and the last decade especially, when it's in his time in the Senate particularly. So I think that's important to point out. Regardless of what people think about his sort of domestic record, he is a part of that system, and he really isn't a leader in any sort of significant sense in terms of principled anti-imperialism. So that's something that nobody should forget. I think for me, my primary area of study is the media. So if I was going to leave listeners with any one point, it's that, you know, in important times like these, when we talk about the U.S. place in the world and problems at home, that it's really important that people sort of get beyond mainstream, what's called mainstream media, and look at more alternative sources. So I've been active in that for the last 15 years in terms of being a part of alternative left media. And I really don't think that we can build a progressive movement in this country until we build a progressive alternative media where we have our own sort of infrastructure for making change. So I would just impress upon people that point. I think it's extremely important.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.